Welcome to the Mountain Rose Podcast. I'm your host, Greg Johnson. On today's show, I'm going to be talking to Steamboat local Kellen Baker. He recently teamed up with Ryan Connolly to do the Grand Traverse Ski Mountaineering Race from Crested Butte all the way to Aspen. Kellen is going to take us through what the race was like, how he prepared, and much more. Kellen, how are you doing?
I'm doing great, Greg. How are you?
I'm doing pretty good. I'm here to talk to you today because you did the Grand Traverse, which is a ski hike from Crested Butte to Aspen. And it deals with it goes over a couple different passes.
Right.
There's a lot of route finding with it.
Right.
And it's a pretty famous race that happens every year. How long is that race?
So this is the 18th year they've ran the race, and it's 40 miles, starts in Crested Butte, like you said. You pass over a couple passes, so we go over Star Pass and Taylor Pass. Yeah, it's definitely a backcountry race. This year there wasn't a ton of route finding just because the snow levels were so down. So the skin track was pretty obvious, and it's actually pretty well marked going through some areas where there might be some decision making. So that part of it was a little easier than I thought, but definitely a tricky race, kind of a slog, you know. 40 miles is a long way. So
and this is your second year doing it, right?
Yeah. Yep. We did it last year, which ended up being the Grand Reverse.
The Grand Reverse. So what happened last year?
So last year there was about 2 feet of snow at the top of the first large pass, and the snow safety teams from both Aspen and Crested Butte communicate about, you know, whether it's safe to put 400 people on the course. And so they deemed last year that first pass was just too sketchy to send the crew over. So we went up just before it, turned around, and ended up doing 40-plus miles back to Crested Butte.
Was it sketchy because there was too much snow and it was a little unstable? Was that the issue?
Yeah. You know, up high above tree line, the danger of an avalanche was great. The skiing was awesome. Would have been great to go into Aspen, but a few passes would have been, haven't seen it this year, would have been really sketchy.
Okay.
To send that many people over.
And so your first year, you really didn't get to do the true race. And it's almost, you have to do it a second year, right?
Right. Yeah. There's something pretty cool about skiing from one awesome resort into Aspen, which is an infamous ski town. So we wanted to come back this year and make it all the way. So yeah, it was definitely one of the big factors that brought us back.
And is it a 400 person cutoff? That's how many people can enter the race, or
yeah,
does it vary?
Yeah, that's what they say. I think they actually let 215 teams in this year.
Okay.
So everybody goes, we go out in two man and women teams. So I think there was about 430 racers this year. And it's mandatory to stay with your partner. There's a number, half a dozen of checkpoints that you need to check in with.
You have to do it with a partner? It's a two-person race.
Correct. Yeah.
Okay, so you can't do it solo.
No. Yeah, you got to do it with a partner. And the idea behind that is you have to be able to spend the night out there, have somebody to be with you in the backcountry if you get lost. And part of that too is having two people carry the mandatory equipment, which is for us, it seemed like a lot. Our packs seem pretty heavy. A lot of the racers have some pretty lightweight gear. There's volunteers that are checking you in. You have to be with your team. You have to have your bib number visible so that they know you make it. But in between that, I mean, there's 10 or 15 miles between most of those checkpoints where it really feels like a backcountry race.
Okay, so let's kind of back up here for a second. And what was the thought of wanting to do the race in the first place? And you do it with your friend Ryan Connolly, local here in Steamboat.
Right.
Nicknamed Twig.
And
was it, this is your second year, so you guys were a team last year as well. How did you guys decide to do it in the first place?
Well, I got to give Twig all the credit for finding this race and signing us up. So first time around, he searched it out, and like most rookies, we didn't really know what we were getting into. I think we liked the idea of doing a backcountry race and skiing from Crested Butte to Aspen. There's something sexy about starting at midnight, skiing through the night, and going into Aspen.
How much experience did you have with backcountry skiing, touring around, hiking up mountains and things like that before you entered the race?
Yeah, not a ton. Definitely not as much as I would say most of the people in the race. But we felt like we were young enough and fit enough to get ourselves in shape. And certainly we didn't take the training lightly for it, because it involves a lot of uphill skiing, almost 8,000 vert over the course of 40 miles. So we definitely prepared ourselves and took the the physical aspect of it pretty seriously.
So your first year, you actually didn't live in Steamboat, right? You were living right, in Conifer?
I was down, yeah, Conifer, outside.
Outside of Denver.
Right.
That first year, what did you do training-wise and maybe him, and how did you find that?
The tricky part about this race and the great part about this race is that you do it as a team. So you start at night. There's a bunch of difficult stretches in the race, and communication with your partner is pretty key. So not being in the same town to train together was definitely tricky that first year. But what I did, I was teaching skiing up at Loveland, so I'd get a skin in before my lesson or after my lesson. The benefit of that was I was hiking at 11 to 13,000 feet, so I was getting not as many hikes in, but some good high altitude training, I guess. And then I'd come up to Steamboat a couple times, and we'd get some hikes in together. And I think the key is getting those long hikes in together. This race is really about getting the mileage under your feet, because it's not really like skidding up to the top of Steamboat, because you're using your climbing bars a lot there. It's a pretty flat race for as long as it is. So I feel like this year we got more mileage in, and we got more mileage in together, and we kind of dialed in our gear and our water and food. So definitely better the second time around.
Did you find it troubling that first year kind of pace-wise? Like, was he a little stronger pace-wise, or were you a little stronger pace-wise?
No, he was stronger pace-wise. I would say both years. He might say that I was stronger this year, but when I came up to Steamboat and we'd just skin in the morning, I was on the verge of throwing up, and he wasn't breaking a sweat. So I had a tough time keeping up with him last year, and I was definitely physically, I was pushed the first time we did the traverse. This year, I was much more prepared, and so was he. He was in tremendous shape, so we were definitely on the same page this year, which is good.
What was the longest hike you did before the race?
Pretty close to 20 miles.
Okay.
Yeah, and so we did that a couple times the month leading up to the race, and we hiked up the mountain, went out Hogan Park and back, and so all in all, it was about an seven, eight-hour hike, almost 20 miles, so that was a really good way to train. It's hard. The race took us 12 hours, so it's hard to convince yourself to go out and spend a day 12 hours on skis, but it was definitely a good way to prepare.
And what did you do differently, would you say, besides the fact that you're in Steamboat and you got to train with your partner more this year? What would you say the big difference was training from year one to year two?
Just going back a second time and knowing what you're in for is huge. So, I knew that the race was flatter than I thought. So I spent a little more time this year going on flatter, longer hikes that my heart rate wasn't spiked immediately. It was more of a sustainable, longer walking hike. And mentally going in, it's nice to just know. It's just nice to know what you're in for as far as gear. And there was definitely more confidence going in, just having an idea where you're going, what you're in for.
And this year, so you did it again year two. And we talked already about, like, you liked to do it year two because you wanted to do the real race, I guess. But was there any other motivation for doing it, or is it something that you want to do again next year?
At the end of last year, I said there's no way I'm doing it again, because I was so maxed out physically, and probably way more mentally, actually, maxed out. But, these things, you give them a year, you get your buddy talking in your ear. So we wanted to get to Aspen, and I wanted to do it with Twig, and I wanted to do it, for him and for me, so I'm pretty content having done it once, but never say never. Don't tell my wife that.
Okay. Yeah. So year two, and maybe year three, we'll see next year.
Right. You never know.
Come time to sign up for the race. This year you felt like, and probably last year a little bit, that your gear was a little heavy.
Yeah, a lot of the field was on AT gear, AT skis, kind of a little bit more specific for this race.
I know that AT gear has come a long way in the last actually just few years. It's gotten lighter. It's gotten easier to switch in and out of. Do you think it was an advantage to have the AT gear compared to the Telemark gear? Or do you think?
Absolutely.
Yeah?
Yeah, I've heard it described as, you're riding down the road in a fat bike versus a sweet road bike.
Okay.
So, but there's, we decided to have Tele gear, and we're stoked on it, and that's what we wanted to do. So I do think it's the lighter gear probably would allow you to ski faster, uphill especially. But there's advantages and disadvantages to it. But for this race, I think the lightweight AT gear is the way most people go. And Probably for good reason.
And the advancements in technology within the last just couple of years here has really kind of changed what people were skiing on and skiing it up on and things like that. Would you agree?
Absolutely. Well, you know, I can't say for sure. Last year was totally an eye-opener when I saw the other teams checking in at gear check. So last year it was the first time I was basically exposed to lightweight carbon fiber boots that are basically the weight of our running shoes, and then small pin system bindings with really small carbon fiber skis. So yeah, it's crazy. It's awesome. It's great to see, and the sport is growing like crazy, and it's an awesome habit, awesome sport.
Well, it's a great way to stay in shape and be outdoors in the wintertime and everything like that. But you also see kind of there's a lot of the companies now that are tailoring gear in that direction,
whereas you
didn't see that a couple of years ago, especially a decade ago. So a lot of change in the last couple of years. What kind of gear did you wear?
This year, last year, the top of Star Pass got about 15 below at midnight. And this year at midnight, it was about 25 degrees.
Big difference.
It was a huge difference. And I never really put on a coat this whole race. I had a couple layers, regular ski pants, and some lightweight gloves with a buff on my head. So there wasn't ever a need to have insulation.
But we
had it. So it was there, and that's the great part of the race. You know, you're prepared and you're ready for anything. But this year it was really mild. Really, really mild, which made for a fast course, kind of a little bit more comfortable night. Last year, my hoses froze up, and then this year, you know, it wasn't an issue with the water at all. So
okay, and you said you felt your pack might have been a little heavier than some other people, and is that just because you're not buying specifically for this race, and the stuff that you have is kind of I'm using it for hiking in the summer and the winter. And it's kind of a lot. I mean, the new gear, and it's always great to have pro deals when you can find them here and there.
Absolutely.
But it's still a big investment. And a lot of those people that were doing the race, at least the veterans you feel like were really serious, did they have kind of stepped their gear game up a little bit comparative, you think?
There's gear that you can buy that's much lighter and usually much more expensive. A lot of those teams had... especially on your feet, I think that the boot is pretty key. So the lightweight boot is key, but also in the pack, you know, you can buy, you know, they make tents that are really, really light, and they make jackets that are really, really light. And it's just a matter of, what you're into. And if it's something that you're passionate about, then it's awesome, you know, go buy everything. But we just didn't have everything. We had everything we needed. We just didn't have everything that was the highest end and the lightest weight. So,
well, you know, cool. I'm sure some people are into this thing to win it, and other people are in it for the experience. And you seem like you're in it more for the experience.
That's what it was. It was the experience this year. We tried to make it as fun and low key as possible. And yeah, exactly. It was about the experience getting to Aspen and skiing through the night and accomplishing a pretty sweet, you know, 40-mile race.
Let's get into the details of the race. So you get to Crested Butte on a Thursday afternoon.
Yeah. Most people arrive either Thursday or Friday. The race starts Friday at midnight. So there's a gear check on Thursday and on Friday. That's where they make sure everybody has everything they need. And they actually will check the top finishers to make sure that they do carry that stuff on into Aspen. So we were not one of those top finishers. So we didn't get checked, but the gear check occurs Thursday and Friday. We got down there, had some pizza, checked into the hotel, and did our gear check.
So the race starts on Friday at midnight. Well, I guess that'll be Saturday at midnight, right?
Saturday,
so Friday night,
exactly.
Saturday morning,
exactly.
Midnight. And is it just kind of a big, I mean, you know, 430 people is a lot of people. Is it a big start, or do they kind of send them off in different groups, or how do they do it?
Yeah, it's a good question. It's pretty fun. Some of Crested Butte's finest are out there, and they're... dressed up, they have a disco band that plays music. So they're at the base of the resort, and they'll have a party going, they'll have music going. And yeah, there's 400 plus people standing at the bottom of the mountain, and kind of like a running race. You kind of know where you stand in the pack. So the faster guys will be up front, and we were kind of in the middle of the pack there, getting ready to go. But it's a mass start, and people start charging right away. Yeah, it's pretty fun.
Nice. And so take me through that a little bit there. So how long did it take you to finish the race in overall?
Right. So we skied into Aspen about 12:45 the next day. So 12 hours and 45 minutes. We skied in just after noon. And the top finishers actually set a course record just because it was a fast course, not much snow, really pretty slick. And nobody had to break trail through.
Yeah, I'm looking here. It's the Hamilton Simmons winner. I don't know exactly who those people are, but they finished in 6 hours, 44 minutes, and 35 seconds out of a total of 215 racing teams. And so take me through that. So you start at midnight, and you're at the bottom of Crested Butte. It's a party almost atmosphere.
It's a party. Yep.
And then you're up and you're off, and people are kind of going at different paces, obviously, and. And do people separate themselves pretty quickly, or is it you kind of in groups for the first about hour, and then you kind of see some distance? How does that work?
The big guns are out right away. So
it's a big climb to start?
Yeah. So you start at the base of the resort, and you do probably a 10 to 15 minute climb up, maybe 20 minutes, and then you ski out the backside of the resort and up a valley. And so when it starts to flatten out down the backside of the East River Valley, it's called, I'm blown away by it. How far the headlamps are already in front of me. And so the leaders really can separate themselves and are really running at a different pace. Those guys have just a stronger engine than most. So those guys were out quick. But you're 400 people, you're in a pack almost for the first 3-4 hours. You're leapfrogging people back and forth and trying to set a pace with, you know, whoever's around you. So you go up Crested Butte and you ski really fast down the backside, really fun, kind of sketchy. I saw one guy face plant really hard down the backside just because you're trying to maneuver around people and obstacles. And then they built a bridge for us to go over the East River, which is usually covered in snow. But so there's kind of a bottleneck there. Some brave people tried to send it over the ice patch.
How'd that work out for them?
Good, actually. There's a ski patrol guy down there named H-Bomb. He was encouraging some riffraff. So people were getting across the river there. After that, it was skis on and off for about 2 hours up the valley.
I don't know if you mean this. So you had to do some boot packing.
Yeah, there was some boot packing because just such a low snow year, similar to us. Once we got up about probably 9 or 10,000, maybe 10,000 feet, the snow started really settling in. So if you're about 2 hours up a valley, and then you cross what's called Death Pass, and then you go up to Friend's Hut. It took us about
so you go from Death Pass to Friend's Hut.
To Friend's Hut, which is pretty welcoming. Yeah, Friend's Hut was pretty welcoming.
Is Death Pass as treacherous as it sounds?
Death Pass didn't have any snow on it this year.
Oh, so it's a boot pack time.
So Death Pass was a boot pack. It's kind of sketchy. If you make a mistake off to your right, you're going into a valley.
Okay.
And that was one of the parts where the snow safety team really made clear that if someone does slip off, it's in Death Pass, it's up to your racers and your partner to let someone know that happened.
Okay.
Because you're kind of in between checkpoints at that point.
At the mercy of, you know, nature at that point.
You're at the mercy of Death Pass. And yeah, for us, it took us a couple more hours to get to Friend's Hut. They gave us 6 ounces of water there.
6 ounces, huh?
Yeah.
Nice people.
Very generous of them. You know, there's someone there checking in, seeing how you are. You basically get a verbal, hi, how you doing? And if someone doesn't look good or sound good, there's medical team there. And that's one of the first turnaround points where the people that are struggling or having gear malfunctions or just can't quite make it, they'll get turned around there before you go over Star Pass.
And you say turned around, does that mean do they have to hike out or
they got to ski right out? Yeah.
Okay. Or is there a play? Is it easy for them, or do they have to go back?
They got
to
backtrack.
Okay.
Which is easier than coming up, but still not easy if you're at the point where you're hurting physically or whatever. So it's always a tough pill to swallow when they tell you to turn around. But luckily, it didn't. Didn't happen to us. And from that point, you head over the first big pass, which is Star Pass, and me and Ryan luckily hit that right at sunrise, and we both said that was kind of the highlight of the tour for us, just because we were able to ski, I want to say 2,000 vert, maybe a little more at sunrise, coming down into that first dip into Aspen. So that was pretty memorable and pretty awesome. The snow wasn't super good, but it was a really, really fun descent.
Yeah.
We were hooting, hollering, and probably expending more energy than we should have, making turns.
Enjoying at least some of it, huh?
Right, yeah, we enjoyed it. So, but yeah, that was about, we got down to the bottom of that. Someone down there was nice enough to have a bonfire and have a little coffee for us. That's someone just being an awesome guy.
Okay.
Yeah. Someone just kind of doing their own thing.
And they probably had to hike in and set all that up.
Yeah. They probably camped overnight there and spent the night helping out the racers. But for anybody who's done a long race like that, it, you know, having someone offer support or just any kind of hello, or it's super helpful. So that was about halfway point. And we kind of trekked into Aspen from there.
Yeah, so when you mean trekked in, I mean, still some up and down, or it's pretty flat, or how's that rest of the race go?
So it flattened out from there a little bit. It was definitely on the whole, it was an uphill to Taylor Pass.
And about what elevation are you at that point, do you think?
I would say we were down just below 11.
And you're kind of hiking slowly and back then we up go in between 11 and 12?
11, 12, and then we top out somewhere above 12 on Taylor Pass.
Okay.
And then we skied into Barnard Hut, which was about 30 miles in. At this point, we put our headlamps away. We're doing it in the light.
Okay.
And it's definitely a boost when you see the sun come up, for sure. It's a definite boost and kind of gives you a little bit of kick knowing that you're making progress and getting that light on you. The hiking in the dark, at least for me, is kind of daunting. So when that sun came up, I was pretty pumped.
Was there a lot of stars, or was it more of an overcast night, big moon? What was
clear night? Yeah, clear, pretty warm, but very clear. And to tell you the truth, you know, I was kind of in the mode where my head was down and I was just hiking, so I wasn't stargazing.
Well, I understand that, and it's kind of some of those times where when there's a nice bright moon on and there's actually good snow, it lights up anywhere.
It can be pretty light,
right? And wasn't the case this time.
Exactly. We were in the woods. We were in and out of the woods for a lot of it. So I didn't notice the presence of the moon as much as I could have. But it was a clear night, and I did take a moment or two at the top of Star Pass just to look around, and it's just beautiful down there. Pretty mountains, and it was a amazing time to be at the top of the pass.
When you get to mile 30, when you get to mile 35, when you get to all these miles and things like that, where are you at?
Right.
Where mentally and physically, and what's the push there for you?
Yeah, so that's a great question. And that was what really hurt me the first year. I made it, but mentally it was such a struggle to get to the end. So at Barnard Hut, we're about 7 or 8 miles away. And at that point, you see some people, they give you some ramen. We both packed in a 12-ounce Coke. So we had a can of Coke at that point, which makes you smile and gives you a little kick. So that was nice. And then, and I'm not going to lie, yeah, the last 7 miles were really tough mentally because it was up and down and we weren't sure whether to put our skins on or off or glide. And we were just in and out of this kind of wavy terrain. So it was kind of seemed like it was never ending. But I think one of the huge benefits of doing it with a partner is that you got someone there to do it with, someone to do it for.
So you know, if one person's down, hopefully another person's up.
Right. And Ryan's the guy that he's slow and steady, and he was charging. He was leading the way the whole way home. He was in front of me, letting me know. We were both in good spirits. And they actually had mile marker marks from 5, 4, 3, 2, 1 into Aspen. So a little bit of a mental boost just to know you're making progress.
Are you actually on one of the resorts when you come into Aspen?
Yeah, we're on Aspen Mountain.
Okay.
I always get those confused. So not Snowmass, not Buttermilk, not Highlands, but
you're on Aspen Mountain. Do you get to take some turns actually to finish the race?
Yeah, the last, I think someone said it was 4,000 vert coming down to the bottom of the gondola. So once we entered Aspen, they check us in, they make sure we have our leashes on our boots, and we abide by all the Aspen Mountain regulations. They gave us a little sip of beer, and yeah, we made 10 minutes of downhill skiing. Going down. So at that point,
I mean, after 39, you know, miles of hiking,
right? We were making beautiful, beautiful telly turns.
I'm sure
all the way down.
I'm sure.
Yeah.
So competition wise, I mean, obviously, you know, we talked about the winner Did it in 6 hours and 44 minutes. It was 45 minutes somewhere right in between there.
Right.
And you guys did it right around 12, right? And so when you're doing it, I mean, obviously some people finish way ahead of you and there's still people behind you, right?
Right.
And are you kind of trying to find some people around your pace and compete with them? Or is it really just more of an individual thing that you and your partner are trying to finish?
Yeah, no, that's a good question. A little bit of both, honestly. So when you're in a pack and you hear someone on your tail, you just kind of want to keep moving and set a good pace. And then when you're out on your own, you just kind of do the best you can. And so right from the beginning, we want to finish. We want to have fun. The experience of getting over there is most important. This isn't a win or lose race for us. So there was never any pressure to pass anybody or not get passed. So if we found somebody that we were jiving with, definitely stick with them. It's nice to be just around.
And I was going to say, would you rather be kind of back and forth with somebody or a few other teams or by yourself? And it sounds like it's better to have some people around to kind of compete with and kind of have that mental distraction almost.
Yeah. Yeah. It's nice to have people around. And it's not, when you're in the middle of the pack like us, it wasn't as competitive as, it wasn't like we were vying for the lead in our little pack just because it was more like someone to joke with and to suffer with and to kind of be like, this is crazy, huh? So we'd have those type of conversations. It wasn't as competitive as it just was friendly.
Okay.
So
what was probably the biggest challenge this year, or maybe a two or three challenges that you faced that you thought challenged you?
Yeah, for sure. I think overall for me, I definitely have to say that the task of going 40 miles is mentally draining. And the last quarter of the race, you really have to, at least my body isn't used to stuff like that. And
so those last 10 miles was a lot of push.
Yeah, you've trained for it and you've prepared for it and you know what you're in for. But after 25 miles, it's kind of like, for me personally, it's like, man, I've been on my feet a long time. So for me, it was definitely a mental challenge. And physically, it was extremely demanding. But this year, I did a much better job of eating and hydrating. You have to really force yourself to eat. And it's amazing how fast food responds to your body, how much it gives you energy. So
we have a little company, Honey Stinger, who does a lot of like stuff that's supposed to respond to your body real quickly, whether it's like these little gel packets or like, you know, protein bars or whatever else. Or did you find that? I mean, you work for Sweetwood, and did you have some jerky and things like that?
Yes.
What did you think worked best?
So we were nice enough to get some contributions from Honey Stinger, Sweetwood, and from Smartwell. We had some sweet socks. So. But as far as food goes, I did a bunch of chews at the beginning of the race. And like you said, they respond almost instantaneously. If you're drained and you have those, they're amazing to give you a little.
So you went with the chews.
Pick me up. So I started with the chews, but it's really, I mean, we're out there for 12 hours.
Yeah.
You got to have a variety. I got to one point where, you know, I just had to move off of the chews and I had some beef jerky and some protein. I also packed in some crackers, Snickers bar,
maybe
Coke,
PB&J,
like I said.
Or anything like that?
I brought a PB&J.
Okay.
Yep. So it's good to have some real food, but it's also good to have those quick energy bursts when you need it.
Yeah, because I remember being on a hike up Quandary, nothing too much, you know, just up to the top where you're skiing and snowboarded down. And I, you know, I had a bar or something. I was taking a break, and I'm next to a guy I don't know and whatever, and he's got a chili relleno from the night before, and I'm just talking. I'm like, yeah. You know, because to me, that sounds like heartburn and hell, I guess you could say, when you're hiking and everything. He's just like, hey, man, you got to have what you like when you're up there.
Totally.
And this is what I find delicious. And
totally.
So, you know, obviously, there's certain things that are made for quick energy, but there's certain things that are comforting and good for you. And you sounded like you had a good mix of those.
Exactly.
Things.
Yeah. No, that's the key to have a good mix. So,
I mean, do you have some favorite parts?
Yeah, I think between Twig and I think we both agreed that, first of all, when the sun comes up, you get a little boost. You're pumped. It's awesome. You know, for us, we're 6 hours in, about halfway. So when we saw the sun come up, that was sweet. And then when we were able to ski, by far the longest descent of the race down Star Pass, an area that neither of us had ever skied before, that was clearly the highlight.
And was it dark then, or
it was twilight?
Okay.
So it was just light enough to see that we didn't need our lamps, which was perfect.
Okay.
So we really couldn't have timed it any better.
Well, any advice for those people out there who find this story interesting and think that they're up for the challenge?
Yeah, no, it's a wonderful, wonderful race. Two great communities. the race directors and on both sides, Aspen and Crested Butte, do a good job of keeping everybody safe, informed, really running a good race. So yeah, I'd recommend it to anybody that wants to try. For me, 40 miles is way longer than it's way longer than it sounds. So training is super key, and having all the right gear on the list that they give you is crucial. But yeah, it's a wonderful experience, and I'd recommend it to a lot of people.
All right. Well, yeah. thanks for talking to me, and I hope you get back at it next year. But we'll see. Like you said, after year one, you weren't so sure. After year two, it sounds like you did it. But
yeah,
maybe if it's a good snow year, and you'll be into it.
Thanks for listening to the Mountain Rose Podcast. I'd like to give a big thank you out to Kellen Baker for stopping by and telling us all about the race today. If you want more information about the race, go to elkmountaintraverse.com. It can give you all the information you need to enter the race next year. I'm your host, Greg Johnson. Stay on the lookout for more podcasts in the future.